Today's episode is sponsored by Umore. Umore helps us better understand and uplift our mental health with instant screening, data tracking, insights, and targeted exercises. I've had the pleasure of having both co-founders on the podcast, and I really admire what they do and love their vision behind the company. Umore is the AI-powered mental well-being tracker that helps you build positive habits, change behaviors, and share your progress with friends, family, and physicians. Umore's vision is to make mental health as seamless and as accessible as possible. Its purpose is to act as a support and prevention tool and to provide you with the data and insights to help you develop an awareness of your current mental state and stress levels. The way it works is very simple. You download the app for free on your smartphone. You fill in a quick questionnaire that will assess how you're currently feeling, which will act as a starting point, and it will check in with you daily to track your well-being over time and so that you are able to see your progression day by day. Umore also gives you access to many evidence-based exercises which are designed to help you live your happiest and healthiest life. The goal of Umore is to be your friend, is there to help and support you in your mental health journey. And to find out more, you can check out their website at umore.app. Hey guys, welcome to Hope It Helps. Today's guest is Giovanni Letford. Giovanni is a globally recognized international DJ and BBC One radio presenter who has been mixing for the past 10 years and has collaborated with some of the world's largest artists such as Craig David, Ed Sheeran, Calvin Harris, and more. He started off his career working as a lawyer for many years and building up his music career on the side, and after going through an unexpected life-changing event, decided to leave the corporate world to focus on his passion of music full-time. During this episode, we discussed his journey transitioning from law to music. He shared with us an incredible story involving a certain member of the royal family and how that affected his music career, and we talked about DJing in all aspects and the importance of branding yourself to further your career. And the last message he wanted to share is don't wait for anyone, create your own opportunities, and if you don't ask, the answer will always be no. Please welcome to the show, Mr. Giovanni Letford.
Hey man, thanks for having me. How's it going?
All good, man, all good. As you know, Christmas time, busy, friends in town, you know, doing all that stuff. And I know you've been having a similar experience as well.
Yeah. Like my cousin just surprised me as well, flew into Dubai yesterday, so I was out last night, you know, so it's good to catch up with people over this time, isn't it? So.
Yeah, 100%. It's like Christmas time, family time, you know, that's kind of how the vibe is. Thanks for coming on the show, man. I appreciate your time.
No, pleasure.
And thank you again. This is round two. The first hour that we recorded was not recorded on this fucking mic. So thank you, Jev, for his patience and patience with this, man.
Practice makes perfect, man.
Absolutely. You've got to make mistakes at some point.
Yeah.
So Jev, me and you met, I think a few weeks ago, through my fiance and your girlfriend, and we were talking about the work you do. You know, I know you're a DJ and a producer and so on, and that you have this really interesting story how you transitioned into music and so on. So I thought I'd love to talk to you today about, you know, your journey with music, how you got to this point, you know, what have you learned along the way, and like just talking about DJing and music, you know, music in general.
Yeah.
But before we get into everything, Jeff, why don't you give all of us a little bit of background about yourself and we'll take it from there.
Yeah, sure. So yeah, my name's Giovanni Letford. I am a DJ, music producer, radio host, and pretty much anything in the creative spaces. And I'd say if you'd asked me, say, 5 or 6 years ago what I'd do, my response would have been completely different. I would have told you I'm a corporate lawyer, commercial lawyer. And I live in Dubai now. I've lived in Dubai for just over a year, enjoying it. And yeah, that's me in a nutshell, really.
And so, guys, we just had a full hour of this, so I'm going to take kind of what we spoke about and try to like add on layer on top of that. So I know your background is in law, right? And you did, you qualified to be a lawyer and stuff, and then you made this transition into music. So it's kind of like a complete, you know, 180. And I really loved when you were talking earlier about how you decided to make that transition and why you decided to make it. So could you walk us through that journey of like, you know, law to music?
Yeah. So I think ultimately I've always been in and around music. My dad DJed when I was younger, although at the time I hated it. Like I used to just want to watch TV and he'd be playing loud music and like reggae music, and I'm just like let me just watch my cartoons, man. But like so I've always been around music. My mum used to sing in the kitchen all the time and she was like cooking and stuff, and then I think I've always been a creative as well. I used to go to drama school when I was younger, However, like, my mum always said to me when I was younger, like, I wanted to be an actor. And I, you know, done a few sort of like films and stuff when I was like a kid. And that was like what I really wanted to do. And my mum was like, Giovanni, just like, you know, do something that you, you know, like go to uni, you know, and at least once you've got your degree, you can fall back on the acting or anything else and stuff. And like my parents hadn't been to uni before. My mum, she basically, she was born in Sheffield, which is, and she moved to London, I think, when she was 16. And she's, her first role was a typist in, in like a magistrate's court or what have you. And she worked her way up to the point where she when she left her, like, because she set up her own business, like, before setting up her own business, she was like in charge of, like, I think it was like four London boroughs, like the magistrate's court. So she, like, literally, you know, like that definition of like working your way up to the top sort of thing. That's kind of what she'd done. But so for her, I guess her passion for me wanting to get a degree is because she hadn't got one, and perhaps she'd seen where, you know, maybe some doors took longer to open because she didn't have necessarily the degree at the time. So like, I'd, you know, gone to uni and I chose to study law. I think at the time, the only reason why I was into law is I used to watch like crime dramas and stuff, and
like Suits and all
And then, like, I was just like, oh, like, but the only law I knew was at the time was criminal law.
Okay.
Yeah, I didn't. Okay. I didn't know that there was like a corporate world or commercial world, or, you know, it wasn't until I went to uni and then I started to like discover business law, or, like, medical law, family law, and intellectual property and stuff like that. And I guess with the music stuff, intellectual property, IP, that kind of interested me, like, from a copyright point of view and all of that sort of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, yeah, like, went to law school, did the LPC, got my training contract. Prior to that, did my internships, vac schemes and stuff. And, you know, I saw myself really wanting to be a lawyer. Like, that was, like, my passion at the time, you know. The DJing at the time was just, like, a side hobby thing. And then, I got my training contract, trained, qualified, and then I qualified into, like, commercial intellectual property. Okay. Then I took a role at Nissan as legal counsel for Nissan, was legal counsel for Europe, so and Benelux, and so basically literally everything from distribution to personal injury to competition,
it's
advertisements.
Pretty heavy, huh? That's a lot of stuff, right?
Literally it was quite intense actually. But I enjoyed it, and I got like a car. Like,
that's always nice.
Yeah. So like and then I left Nissan and then eventually went to Good Hair Day, GHD. They do like hair straighteners and stuff. And I was legal counsel for them, similar sort of role to at Nissan. And then, yeah, like eventually I found myself transitioning out of law into, you know, doing the music stuff, the music, more, full time, you know.
Yeah. Mm. And like we were talking about earlier, I think it's really interesting that even after you qualified as a lawyer, even now with the music that you do, you still do some stuff on the side, like some work, you know. So it's like your fail-safe is kind of building with you, you know, because you're building that portfolio, working with different types of clients and so on, separate from like the thing you love to do, which is like music, you know, and production, I think, which is pretty awesome. I'm curious, if you had the chance from the beginning to go straight into, like, you know, if your parents hadn't said, like, you know, you don't need to get a degree, like, just from now you can go pursue your thing.
Mm.
Do you think you would have done that? Do you think you would have been further along than you are now? Or, like, when you look back in hindsight, are you comfortable with that decision?
I think, yeah. I think ultimately I'm comfortable with the decision.
Sure.
I feel like there's been, you know, there's a lot of stuff that I learned along the way, through going through that process of, you know, becoming a lawyer, that I think has really sort of set me up in good stead today, you know, from, like, you know, just the ability to kind of, you know, stick at something, and, you know, the discipline that comes with, you know, like focusing on one thing. And like, I also think that just from a business acumen point of view, I probably learned quite a lot, you know.
Exactly.
Being a lawyer and looking at businesses and helping businesses and stuff. And also now, like, when it comes to, like, my events company or any of my other businesses, like, a lot of the time I'll look at the contracts myself, you know. So
exactly. Yeah, that's true.
And when it comes to like IP and copyright, etc., you know, I think a lot of creatives, especially historically, they sometimes can get taken advantage of because they don't necessarily have the knowledge or, you know, or know how to kind of, you know, like, know how to kind of present themselves, you know, sure. when it comes to certain contracts and stuff. So definitely that, for me, I don't regret going through what I went through.
Sure.
Sometimes I do think though, like, I look at like, so I DJ for KSI and stuff, and
You
know, he dropped out of college, you know, and you look at like, say, Kanye West, college dropout, and you know, and you look at like Jay-Z and you know, even like DJ Khaled and all these sort of people, and you know, you look at, and a lot of them tend to not have necessarily got the, you know, pursued that career, you know?
Yeah.
But I think, you know, everything happens for a reason, and
for sure.
you know, like I'm happy and excited with the journey that I'm on, you know. So yeah, I think, you know, if given the opportunity, could I be like where I am today without having gone through or enjoyed, you know, the process of becoming a lawyer? I'd say no, I still would have gone through that, you know, like I've made lifelong friends, you know, doing that,
yeah,
and it shaped me to be who I am today. So
100%. No, and I think that I think you made referencing like those guys is a good point, but at the same time, I think it's, if you're being realistic, like how many like of those guys are there in the world that haven't made it, and you know, and never have, and they're still, you know, trying to do that and still struggling to get, you know, to get to that stage. And I think that you mentioned a good point about how the business acumen that you get from that experience, and that the fact that contracts and all that kind of stuff, you can do it, you know, you understand, you know, the legal terms and like how it works, so you make sure like you don't get screwed over or people you're working with don't as well. And I think it now you can do two, you know, you have two different avenues that you can go by, and you can do them both, which I think is pretty cool too. So if you're interested, you know, can continue your interest in this and, you know, still do the music as well. And so I know you mentioned that you've been DJing professionally loud for about five, six years now. And you were telling me earlier about how different events have different pressures. So things like a wedding DJ or a corporate DJ or like a tour DJ, for example. So could you tell us, I guess, different pressures that you've experienced or felt working in those different like areas?
Yeah. So I'd say, yeah, professionally, I've been DJing for, say, 5-6 years as a professional. But I first started DJing in 2010, so maybe 11 years or so. And there's definitely like every gig comes with some sort of pressure. Like,
yeah.
And I think the moment that, you know, I start to turn up to, I mean, like even like the easiest of gigs, you know, like my own parties, for example.
Yeah.
There's a pressure, not necessarily on the DJ inside maybe, but like, you know, there's an issue at the door, someone can't get in, or, you know, and then someone comes to me with an issue and I'm like, oh, I just want to DJ. And like, yeah, like even at my brunch last week, like no one from the venue came up to me once. I'm standing around, and as soon as I jump on the decks, it's like, now all these issues are here. Like, it's like, why didn't you ask me before I jumped on the decks? And then like someone's like, oh, someone's downstairs. And I was like, okay, well, who?
I need some more information.
Yeah. And but yeah, like, I think, you know, I've had pressures in all forms. So like, from I guess like a wedding point of view, like there was a particular wedding I DJed at, and the bride, her family were, well, the bride was from Canada, but her parents are Ghanaian. So she flew in her family from Ghana, and then the groom, he's from England, and his family are English. And they both got married. They're actually both good friends of mine. And they like, you know, we'd gone through a brief of like music policies and stuff. And but like, so the Ghanaian family, they wanted like Afro beats and stuff. And so the Ghanaian mother in particular, and the English mother, she wanted like more sort of like Rod Stewart, and, you know, I guess a lot more sort of, I guess stuff that you'd hear at a traditional English wedding.
Sure,
you know?
Sure, yeah, and the classics.
And so like, I was, you know, navigating between the two and stuff and that, but literally I felt like I was being pulled both sides by, like, you know, like literally, and it got to the point where I was just like, this is, I feel like they're almost competing with each other. You know? Like,
you know, who's going to get the music?
Yeah. Do you know, you go to a club or something, and like me as a DJ in the club, and sometimes, you know, you might, depending on what type of club it is, there might be like a music artist on one side of the club, and then he buys a bottle, and then And then another music artist is on the other side, and he's like, oh no, I want to get one. And then they're like competing.
Yeah.
It was like that, but it was this time it was me in the middle and they were like stretching, you know. And then, but it got to the point, that was probably the most stressful gig. And I was like, I joked with them afterwards. I was like, look guys, I love you both, but I'm never doing an interracial wedding again. Like, but to be honest with you, like, I mean, I have done interracial weddings since then. And so that was a pressure in terms of, I guess, appealing to different demographics and stuff, you know, which is unique to a wedding compared to, say, you know, if I'm DJing in a club or a bar where people that are going to that particular venue are have similar music tastes and similar
interests.
You're
going interests. For that kind of vibe.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Exactly. So, and then I guess, yeah, another pressure was when I was on tour with KSI and, you know, I pushed play on a track and the song I pushed play on didn't come out. It was another song that I had no control of. And I was like, I pushed stop. And then he looks at me and he's like, what's going on?
Yeah.
And then I'm like, look, and I've turned the volumes down and the music's still playing. And I'm like, it's not me. And then that was basically the production team, like the sound guys and stuff. I think they had their Spotify or something
connected.
And then they forgot to switch it over. So that was what was playing. And it was some random song as well. Like,
yeah, like
so,
nothing to do with anything.
Yeah. So yeah, like I think they all come with their pressures. I do feel like the pressures that I get from DJing are pressures that I'm a lot more happy to endure than the pressures at the most, you know, when I was doing law, like, you know, when I was doing all my, like, late nights and, you know, in law, like, those were pressures because I guess with music I'm passionate about it and I enjoy
exactly,
it.
Exactly, yeah.
Whereas with law, the only reason why I was there, I wasn't really enjoying it. It was more, like, literally there just for the security of a good career and what comes with that. Like, but ultimately, when it came down to, you know, doing like 3 a.m., like finishing at 3 a.m., 4 a.m. on like a banking deal or something, like I hated it.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Whereas like, you know, at 3 a.m., if I'm getting shouted at by someone that's saying, hey, Justin Bieber, like that's much better than, you know.
It's a lot easier to handle that. I can throw that in, quick fix.
Yeah.
I was thinking about something that you, on the wedding example that you said, and interracial weddings and that they're, you know, different cultures, different kind of music.
Mm.
Do you, like, let's say you had to play a wedding, for example, another one, different people of different cultures, but it's, for example, maybe like, I don't know, Spanish, French music, Arabic music, you know, very music that is not, that you don't really, like, know yourself.
Yeah.
Have you had those experiences? And if you have, is it, how challenging has it been to understand, like, how to even mix those together in, like, a nice way, you know what I mean?
Yeah. So, like, with weddings, I've done, you know, like, for example, a couple of Indian weddings And what I do with any sort of like bride or couple is I'll sit down with them, whether that's in person or over Zoom or on the phone, just to find out what music they like, their do's and don'ts and stuff. And then eventually together we create like a 20 to 50 track song list of stuff that they definitely want in there. We tend to do it on Spotify because we can share the playlist and stuff.
Yeah, it's easier, right? Yeah.
And then, for example, this Indian wedding in particular, there was like a load of Bollywood songs that they wanted to play. So they gave me the names of them. I was like, if any of them that you've got, and we can do it one of two ways. Like you can either give me the names, I'll go and source them. Or like if you wanted to send me them, most of the time I'll just go and source them. So it's easier for the bride and groom and that. And then, I'll listen to them beforehand and stuff. And then, eventually on the night sort of, I'll have my folders. So like on my laptop, I've got my different folders and within like my folder so that there's like my club stuff and then I can minimize that and then a little bit later further down it's corporate stuff and I can minimize that and then there's the wedding one and then every single wedding that I've done there's like a playlist there sort of and sometimes I find that like there's tracks that are common with a load of the weddings and stuff and then like
okay, that's true actually yeah
but then like the Indian wedding so like that particular couple within there there's a load of like their, say Bollywood songs and stuff that you know I've then gone and played and then to be honest with you like I've then, because I've seen the reaction of them, when I've gone to like another place where I know that there's like maybe like a handful of like Indian people, I've been like, let me just throw this in and see what happens.
They're
going crazy for it. So yeah.
I think what you said makes a lot of sense about, I think prepping beforehand, like going sourcing it yourself and like listening to it to give you an idea of like, where could this fit in? How could this fit in? Is super important. But that, and when we were talking earlier, you were talking about how in the early days you used to have just a, like playing at clubs or whatever, just a track list. And the goal was to just, you know, focus on the mixing and so on. And just to like play those tracks like sequentially, that's how you thought the night should run. But you also talked about how important it is for you to notice the audience. And I'm guessing, have you, like, I'm sure over time you improve and you start reading the audience better, but have there been times, like, I guess maybe earlier in your career, when you're just following that track, that you played a song and, you know, the audience just doesn't kind of react to it? And other times, maybe when, like, you weren't playing the vibe of the audience and then you played one and, oh, you caught them. Like, that's how you got them. Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, when I first started DJing, I can even remember, like, the first, like, club / bar gig that I did. And I remember, like, lead up to it, I was in my room, and this was when I was on campus at uni still. And I'd, like, downloaded the songs that I wanted to play and I'd put them in order, and I was like, this is how I'm going to structure the set. And then so I went in to play it, and I just kept my head down. I played track one, and I mixed in track two, and I mixed in track three, and I wasn't looking at the crowd at all or anything. So I didn't know if they were having a good time. And I think that was because I hadn't yet built the confidence to look up and look at the crowd and read the crowd, and, you know, and some of the songs they connected with. And then if I'd knew about reading the crowd, I would have probably been like, oh wait, they're enjoying this style.
More than that.
Yeah, let me stick on this. But because I was following my track list, I just kind of just didn't see that they were like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then I'll go to the next one, and then their mood might have gone down, but because I'm not looking at them, I can't tell. And it's only after a while you really then, I guess through being out, watching other DJs, watching people in the club and people watching and stuff, and then, you know, the more you DJ, the more you're like, actually, yeah, you need to, like, play to your audience. So then eventually I did, like, got this formula, which was wherever I DJed, whether I came in at the peak of the night or at the beginning of the night as people are coming in, I'd identify a group of girls and I'd be like, okay, that's who I'm playing for tonight. If these girls are happy and dancing, then they're going to empower other women to dance, and naturally the fellas are going to follow. So that's kind of the formula I've had. And I mean, now it's a bit different, it's a bit more, like, flexible. So sometimes it might be a group of guys that I want to play for and stuff. And I think definitely now, you know, I think that's a key skill that a good DJ should have, is the ability to read the crowd and know your audience.
Exactly. Yeah, so you can vibe, because, like, listening to you, it's kind of like a collaboration between you and the audience. We both need to be on game for this, you know, to work. Like, I need your help, and they need you to play the music to get them there, but you need them to keep them there.
This is it.
You know what I mean? Yeah. I was thinking, you know, when you're DJing, and, like you said, there's sometimes you come on at the beginning, sometimes you come on at the end of the night. So different points in the night have, like, even events or concerts, whatever, have different vibes. And sometimes, because I've heard, like, I've watched, like, you know, on YouTube and stuff, like, DJs talking about how, like, they're the headliner, and the DJ came on before just came and, like, played this, like, unbelievably, like, high energy music, like, maybe even some of, like, the big hits, and, like, just kind of ruined that opening, and then they come in and it's like the crowd's already, like, here, and that's not where you want to start and whatever. So have you had those kind of experiences, and, like, how does, I guess, because a night needs to have a flow. There needs to be a flow of music. It needs to start somewhere and kind of build as it goes on. So could you walk me through, like, kind of the vibe of how that works?
I completely. So there's been countless times when, like, I've been booked to play, say, like, midnight or something, and there's been countless times where I've been booked to play midnight, and the DJ before me, for example, I've come in and it's just high energy. And I'm just like, whoa, like, because ultimately, like, I think there are a lot of DJs that don't understand the structure to an event.
And
I think the reason why I perhaps understand it is because, you know, before I was a DJ, I was throwing parties and throwing events. So I used to book DJs, and I used to, you know, that, say this, the event was, say, 10 till 3 a.m., I'd be like, okay, 10 to 11 is a warm-up. So then I'd book a DJ, and I'd be like, oh, this is the part of the night where you're warming the crowd up, so can you play this, etc. Then the next DJ, I'd be like, oh, can you play, it's not quite the peak of the night, but, you know, you want to take them out of the warm-up to, like, get them dancing and stuff. And I think because I'd structured events like that, so when it came to me DJing, I always automatically knew that certain parts of the night required a different energy. But a lot of DJs that DJ, they don't necessarily know like that. So, like, there's a DJ in Dubai, actually, I won't mention any names and stuff. And I've kind of had to, he's actually a very well-known DJ and stuff, but he's only ever really done, like, main sets. So and then so when he started to DJ at my event in Dubai, and, you know, like, even if I wasn't, sometimes I don't DJ at my event, sometimes I'll just have other people DJing. So there was this one time when I wasn't DJing, I was just like wanting to observe the event. And he started at like 10 p.m, 11 p.m, playing like all the bangers and stuff. And I was like, what's going to happen is that everyone's going to be excited and stuff. And then by like midnight, everyone's tired because they've burnt out, you know?
Yeah.
So what you want to do is you want to take them on a journey, you know, like up, down and stuff, up, down. And even in the peak of the night, you know, like you still want to like maybe play a couple of songs that, you know, are a little bit less energetic, but, you know, maybe some stuff that they can sing along to rather than jump to.
And
then, you know, that will give them an opportunity to go and get a drink and then come back and go again, you know? So...
Yeah, it's interesting, and I guess from your, especially from your point of view, because since you run it, so you're a DJ and like the organizer of the event. When you're DJing, I guess, you know, you're in your vibe, you know, you can read the audience, whatever. But I think it's also interesting that when you're not, you get that, you know, like third eye perspective, you know what I mean? Yeah. You see, okay, how is this running based on like what music they're playing and stuff? And I guess that kind of, or does that help you, like getting that information when you're just observing, does that help you like the next time you're going to play, like how to like read the events and manage it better?
Yeah, definitely. And to be honest with you, even like when I'm, if I have a set, I like to go a little bit earlier so I can see how they're reacting to what's being played already.
Okay.
And then I could be like, okay, this hasn't been played or this has been played. What can I do now to, like, I've seen that the audience are either a bit flat or very energetic. How can I kind of do my set to give the audience the best experience, basically, based on where they're at now?
Yeah.
You know, there have been times when, you know, the DJ performing has been mad energetic. So then I've had to come on and rather than, you know, instantly come and flatten the thing, I've had to come on that same energy.
Yeah.
And then eventually slowly but bring it back round again. So
yeah, that, like, you know, level it out kind of, right? And I think, like when... it's such high energy, it might, like, because I think as a DJ you want, I think no matter what time you're playing and what thing you like, you want to begin that journey from whatever point that the thing is at, you know. But if you're already like at the end, it's really hard, it's because hard, you don't want to bring it back down because everyone's already vibing, you know. Especially when you start playing like the old school classics that everyone's like stuff. I'm just curious, so I asked you earlier what it means to be a good DJ, and you said two things. It was a combination of, I guess, technical talent, you know, being able to mix and so on, but also reading the audience. Mm. Is there another factor about being a good DJ that maybe we haven't talked about, or an area that people don't talk about enough that you've maybe learned from your experience?
So I think, you know, obviously technical skills and then, you know, reading the audience. And I think aside from that, I think it's just about knowing that, like, it's not about you, you know?
There you go.
So, like, a lot of people might think, oh, it's about the DJ and stuff, but, you know, like, for me, sort of, like, yeah, I love it when people are, like, coming up to me, like, oh, yeah, but ultimately, like, the moment it's all about me and I'm just playing to myself or playing because I want to just impress people about me rather than playing to make people have a good time, then that's when, from my observations of other DJs and experiences in general, that's when you as a DJ like start to lose your connection with the audience and stuff.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah, like I've seen DJs that will like play to impress other DJs, you know, that are around and stuff, but then ultimately you might impress that other DJ, but then the person that's booked you, or the person that, you know, might book you in the future to DJ, they might just be like, I didn't quite connect with that person, you know?
Okay.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Because I think, with every art form, there's, I think, that struggle, whether it's photography, whether it's art, whatever, between doing what I want to do and I guess doing what people are going to like gravitate to. You know, there's that different thing. Sometimes, you know, you're lucky when you hit that one that it all connects, but not a lot of time, you know, it's not necessarily like that, right? So it's kind of like, it's interesting. It's because it's almost a different way of like looking at it. It's, I think a lot of people maybe thought, I'm curious, early in your career, was it, I'm guessing it would have been more about, because you're still earning your stripes and whatever, and you're trying to build your name as a DJ. Was it more about I want to do the best job, like the way I want to do it, so people start recognizing me. Did it take you time to start to realize that I make that adjustment?
Yes and no. So I think I always knew. So based on my experience, so one thing I guess that we didn't touch on earlier actually was one of the things that made me decide that I really wanted to get into DJing as well was that like I had an event on and. Sorry, I was DJing last night, so I think I had an event on and I booked this DJ and I was like, look, whatever you do, there's that this half an hour, I just want at least half an hour of you playing Tupac and Biggie classics, you know? And he didn't play anything of it and I was just like, right, why didn't he? And the frustration for me there was like one, I love music so much, and two, you know, at the time I wasn't technically didn't really know how to DJ and stuff, and I was like, but if I knew how to DJ then I would have just done it myself. And so that's one of the things that was like, you know what, actually, yeah, I'm gonna actually take the DJing seriously. But the other side of that for me is that I was like frustrated as an event organizer
yeah,
and I was like, I'm never gonna book that DJ again. So for me, I know that like I can go, if someone books me to play something, I need to play that basically. Ultimately, if I want to be booked by that person again, or if I want them to refer me, you know.
True.
Obviously, now I'm at a place where when I DJ, a lot of the times people say, just do you.
You built that credibility for yourself, right?
Yeah. So, but definitely in the early stages for me, it was like, I was definitely going to do the best job to impress. But like some DJs think to impress is at 10 o'clock to play the Drake and to play, you know, all the bangers and stuff.
Yeah, the big boys, yeah.
And, but like, so like my friend who I went to uni with, she started DJing a few years ago and she was asking me for like a set and stuff. And she'd been asking for a while. So I was like, okay, you can do a warm up set at my my event. This is back in London.
Yeah.
And then I was watching her and she was just playing all the bangers and stuff. And I knew straight away she was trying to impress me to be like, look, I can play all this stuff. But she wasn't thinking about the night as such. So sometimes it's just a conversation with DJs and being like, look, as much as I know you're seeing this as an interview for yourself, the actual way to pass that interview is to actually warm the night up properly.
Exactly.
But some DJs think, oh, I need to play the bangers to impress.
To be noticed. To get this.
And once I explained that to her, she had the eureka moment and stuff. And I think the reason why no one explained it to me as a DJ is because I used to curate events beforehand, so I already knew that, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you had that experience of how it kind of should run. And this is actually a good point. This is something we didn't touch on earlier. So you said you've been running events for, you know, quite some time now on different scales and so on. So I guess what for you in your mind is like, what makes a good event? What is it that you can finish, you know, the event's done, you go back and you're like, yeah, that was a good one, or that was a bad one, maybe.
I think finances aside, you know, like
obviously, of course,
I need to make a profit. But I think for me, what makes a good event that I've run is if the customers are happy, ultimately, if the guests are happy, and the music has been, you know, to a high standard.
Okay,
those are to me the two things. I know I need. Everyone that's come there to have had a positive experience, a good experience, to the point where they'd actually want to come back again. And the music needs to be good, sort of like, you know, there's been times when I've done events and, you know, like, you know, I've booked a DJ and perhaps like I listened to a mix and the mix made me think that they could do certain things. And then when they were there, they couldn't do it. Yeah. And then that then to me makes me conscious that, oh, people might not be enjoying themselves as much. So I think for me, yeah, that's the main thing for me that makes a good event is if the people are happy, you know?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I guess people, I guess that memory, you know, like, you know, the customer saying, oh yeah, that was a sick event. You know, I can't wait for the next one. I guess that's what gives you that vibe, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I feel that. And coming on to, I know you mentioned earlier that when you made the transition, you had already been like doing it for a while, like DJing and stuff. But then you started like, you know, getting booked for like bigger gigs and so on. So, but you said earlier that you didn't consider yourself a professional for a while, which I thought was, you know, very interesting. So could you tell us, I guess, at what point you felt that, you know, I'm a professional now, and like, this is like, I'm that, you get that, I guess, inner confidence that, no, this is going to work.
Yeah. So for a long time, I didn't see myself as a professional DJ. You know, I was still a lawyer. I was still focused on my career. And I just saw it as like a side hobby, you know, like I'd bring a few friends along, we'd have some beers and stuff and, you know, I'd do DJing and that. And then I guess like as I started getting more, I actually had imposter syndrome. Like I was like should I be here? Like I'm a lawyer. Like why am I, you know, and I didn't want DJs to know that I was a lawyer as well, you know, and all of that sort of stuff. And I think for me, there was a shift at some point when I was like, do you know what? Actually, yeah, I'm actually a professional, even though it's not my profession, because people were like, oh, do you DJ professionally? And then, and I know sometimes when people ask that, they're asking, do you DJ full time? Sometimes they're like, as in, because, you know, like if someone says you're a professional lawyer, you'd assume that, you know, they work full time as a lawyer, right?
Sure. So, yeah.
So exactly. I knew that when people were asking me, do I DJ professionally? They were asking me if I'm a full time DJ. So my response was always, I'm a professional DJ, but it's not my profession, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I get you. Yeah.
And the moment when I started saying I'm a professional DJ, but it's not my profession, that's when I noticed the shift. And I think it was probably when I realized that people had started to buy into me as a brand.
Yeah.
And that's when I was like, okay, yeah, actually, I'm not just like a bedroom DJ anymore. I'm not just someone who, you know, when we went to, was it to Holidays or something like that? And then I can't remember. I was having a conversation with someone, and then Grace was like, he's a DJ. And then I think someone was like, oh, everyone's a DJ. But then I think he was thinking, oh, he's a DJ in terms of like everyone's a DJ. You know, like everyone has a USB stick and mixes and, you know, like and stuff like that. And then and I don't think they and so I, obviously what he probably perceived me to be as a DJ is what at one point I would have perceived me to be, you know, like I'm a DJ, but so is this person, you know, everyone's a DJ. Whereas now, like I'd say I'm a professional because people buy into me as a brand and people
exactly
subscribe to what I do and stuff. So,
yeah. Mm. And I think you made a good point that about, you know, the importance of brand and people to buy into you, because that's what gives you the credibility to get more opportunities, to get bigger events, to get, you know, all that kind of stuff. But I was also thinking, as you were speaking just now, like I remember when I first was learning how to DJ on the CDJ 200s and learning literally like how to like beat match.
Yeah, yeah.
But now, as you know, with all the like new equipment and stuff, you could be a DJ and without just like sync. And like, it does that. So I think it's become a lot easier for people to become DJs, but I still think that if you learn the old way, because I guess that's how you really train your ear and, you know, to, like press that cue button like a million times, like, until it's, you know, time to play. So do you think that it's crucial, like to become a good DJ in like now 2021, do you need to have that, like, I guess that background or like foundation of genuinely like the analog version of learning how to beat match and like listen, like really train your ear and stuff? Or is it now that's not really a needed thing anymore and like you can still do good?
That's a very good question, because I have this conversation with like a lot of my DJ friends, and I think that, you know, like for example, there's an artist called Wizkid, and he had a London.
Oh yeah, Wizkid, of course.
Yeah. He had his like London show, and the DJ that was sort of warming up for Wizkid had like a controller. It was like a small controller that they'd put on top of the decks. And like, you know, you could clearly see that it, like they didn't know how to beat match. It was syncs and stuff. And me personally, like because I was a music lover before I became a DJ.
Yeah.
For me, I have no issue with people who love music wanting to share music, you know. And ultimately, that's what a DJ is doing, is sharing music, playing music to an audience. And like, I know a lot of DJs that would be like, it's not proper DJing and, you know, and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Me right now, where I'm at, I feel like as long as they, because also with DJing, it's about music selection as well, track selection and stuff.
Of course.
And like, for me, I'm glad I know how to beat match, you know, the old way.
Yeah.
And I'd feel like I've cheated the DJing system if I didn't know how to do that. But, you know, I'm not going to be snobby at someone that, you know, doesn't know how to beat match, you know, like technology, you know, technology arrives in various sectors and industries, you know, and it changes the way people do their jobs and stuff. And naturally, that's going to happen to DJs, you know. Like, for example, I can play on turntables, but I know a lot of DJs from my generation who can't. And I know that the turntable DJs are looking at DJs who are using CDJs and, like, and the same thing. So, like, you know, and maybe in 10 years' time, like, that there'll be, I don't know, some next device that these controller DJs
are now.
Exactly, yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I think ultimately, as long as that person can read the audience and, you know, has the good track selection as well. But then, you know, there's certain things that I think should be reserved for DJs who can DJ in a traditional sense. You know, like, even stuff like, you know, you have, like, on, you know, like, YouTube, like the Red Bull Championships and stuff.
Yeah.
Like, that, all of,
like,
that.
The scratchers.
That's, you know, that respect. Yeah, like, that will never change, I think. You know, that will still be, you know, a platform for those DJs and that, you know, so.
Yeah. Mm. I think you made a good point that, you know, as time goes on, the old guard or people who were in it before you had this technology or this thing that makes it easier for you to do are always going to look at it, probably always going to look at it in that way. So I think, you know, I think that's a good point. But in the sense that, I guess we talked about branding, if we took the branding, I guess, out for a second and we just focused on, like, the DJing aspect, there's so many DJs in the world, and there's a lot of very good, you know, there's a lot of very good DJs who may be more technical than you, could read a room better than you. So I guess, how do you make yourself, I guess, stand out? Does it all come back to the branding? Is that what you think? You know, what's your take on that?
So, like, one of the things that I learned very early on in life and in my corporate career in particular is it's all about perception.
Sure.
Everything is perception. And so, you know, again, you know, like, you'd go to, say, if you went to a job interview, like, you wouldn't, because I started to look at myself and I asked myself, are people looking at me as a DJ or as a lawyer? And I was like, you know, I think at the moment, if someone was to go on my Instagram page, this is like 5-6 years ago, they would see Giovanni and see him as a lawyer who DJs in his spare time.
Like, yeah.
And I was like, I want to shift that. I want people to look at me and see me as an international DJ, you know, like. So for me, I then started to look at the perception and I was like, do you know what? I need to document my journey more, you know, even if I, you know, because I was doing Ibiza, like, and stuff like that, but I wasn't really documenting it. And,
yeah,
you know, so
yeah,
I started to, you know, I paid a videographer to like shoot me DJing in Ibiza and stuff like that. So then I posted that and I was like, let me just, these small little things that help create the brand, Giovanni Letford,
exactly,
and stuff, you know.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It meant that I could then go to another, like, organization or whoever and be like, oh, I'd quite like to play for you, or they'd approach me and I'd be like, can I see your profile? And then they'd be like, okay, he's done this, he's done that. Okay, yeah, do you know what? Like by nature of him being at these places, he must be good.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, exactly.
And then they're more likely to buy into you. So yeah, I think branding is very important for anything, you know? And definitely even for DJing, in order to, I guess, propel your career, like, to the next level and stuff. And I think certainly a lot of DJs in London are now cutting in onto that.
Okay.
I think I was probably one of the, like, quite early on, I cutting onto it. So, you know, I made sure I had my website, made sure I had business cards, made sure I had, like, logo and like, a press kit and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, whenever I do anything, so, like, I did, like, Top Man, I did Wingstop, and I did, like, all these, like, store activations and stuff, I just made sure I had a videographer there with me to capture it.
Of course, because I guess that's, like you said, the more content you have, that's the more social proof you have and the more credibility that it builds you, right? Speaking on this is funny, we didn't get into it last time, so I'm happy. Speaking about business cards, I saw a funny story. I'm not gonna ruin it for anyone, you know what I'm talking about. I was like, because I was looking through, like, Instagram, and I always do research, you know, my guests and stuff. So I went, like, to the site. I'm like, okay, just clicked on this. And I started reading. I'm like, what the fuck is this? This is nuts.
Yeah.
You know, but I also, like, I'm not going to ruin it for anyone. Why don't you tell us the story that I'm talking about?
Yeah. So
it's fantastic.
So this is one of the things that made me enabled me to leave law a lot sooner than I'd planned. I'd had, like, a 5-year plan.
Yeah.
And then this made me leave law, like, within a year of making that plan. And basically I went viral because I gave happened to have my business card and said I want to DJ at your wedding and stuff. And then it gained a lot of traction, and I ended up on like ABC News, CNN, BuzzFeed, yeah. Good Morning Britain, literally everywhere. And then it got to the point where like they were calling my office to try and speak to me. And so like this was when I was at Nissan, and then like HR were like, Giovanni, take a week off till it dies down and then come back. And during that week off, you know, like I did loads of TV interviews, radio interviews. I did a Snickers advert with Elton John. And
oh, wow. Yeah. That's
so
insane.
Yeah, yeah. So like all of this stuff happened. And then I was like, I can't go back to the office after this. So I just said, look, guys, like, I don't know if I can come back. And they were like, oh, they had a feeling that this might happen. But because they didn't want to get in the way of the opportunity, especially because there was so much media around, like they allowed me to, you know, like, normally I'd have to do like 2-3 months notice or whatever, like work 2-3 months notice, but we came to like an arrangement and stuff. And then, yeah, like, you know, the wedding and stuff, you know, that was the catalyst for me to, that kind of, like, the moment I had all of that behind me, it just meant that it made it a lot easier just to go into, to open certain doors.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. Because you got so much, like, like a lot of exposure, you know, for something like that, being on those talk shows and so on. Mm. Did you actually get to play at their wedding?
So, yeah, I did.
You did?
Yeah, but I can't, I signed an NDA.
That's fine.
So, like, all I can say is that, basically.
You did.
I can't go into detail or anything like that. But online, there's a couple of bits about it, you know.
That's fucking awesome. So I read the article, but then in my head I'm like, it all talked about that, like, you gave him like the business card, but it never said, like, I never found a place, like, did he play the wedding? I had no idea. So you did.
That's
a pressure wedding.
that's
a pressure wedding.
That was
what an experience.
Literally. And it frustrates me because, like, even my mum, like, I haven't, there's certain things that, you know.
Yeah, respect.
That I haven't even said to, like, I didn't think at all that I'd even be, you know, within, like, close distance.
Yeah, how did you actually, like, see him and give it to them?
So before I get into that, like, one thing, and this is why I believe in, like, manifestation and stuff, like, because, when they announced that they got engaged, like, as a joke, like, I mean, I'd never once thought that I would come into contact with them. As a joke, I just created a Facebook event page, and it was like, Giovanni DJs at a wedding. okay. I invited my friends along, and then before I knew it, there was like 300 people attending or whatever, just that, like, as a banter thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, like, that was like 6 months before I'd even was going to even come into contact with them. Then the radio station. So I used to do a lot of stuff with a radio station, a community station, and called Represent. And
Represent.
Yeah. And like, they are partially funded by the Prince's Trust. Prince, well, Harry and Meghan's first like public outing as an engaged couple was to come to the station and see what, you know, the projects that the station had going on and stuff. And I remember I took a half day at Nissan. And like I said, because of this whole imposter syndrome, I didn't want to go to the station in my suit.
Yeah.
So I took my half day at Nissan, and then I had to go all the way home. I don't know why I didn't bring my stuff. Because I was in the Nissan head office, which I drove to. So I had to drive back home and then get the train into where the station was. So I drove home, changed into something more casual, and then like hopped on the tube to Brixton, where the station was. And because of all of that, I was a little late. So I think we were told to get there for about 1. I got there about 1:40 or something. And so it meant that I was at the back. So some of the presenters from Represent had already gone into the studio. Prince Harry was in the studio. He was like, you know, just being shown around. Like, he was on someone's radio show. They were all talking. In my mind, I was like, oh, I'm not going to get to meet them. But it's fine. Like, you know, it's a cool environment. You know, like, it's a nice little day out. Even if I see them, do a little video, like, from afar or whatever. But because I was the last one in, and I was at the back, there's about 100 people there, members of public who'd been invited. It turned out that was the front. I didn't realize.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Because so when they came in, they stopped sort of around, sort of like near the entrance to the studio, outside though. And then they just happened to like stop in front of me. So I just tapped him, gave him my business card. And then he was like, what's that? And I was like, it's my business card. If you need a DJ for your wedding, And then he put it in his pocket, and then someone filmed it from behind me. And then there was like, as he put it in his pocket, everyone cheered. Like, and then he was like, oh, I've got a video. I was like, oh, send me that. So he sent me the video, and then I just tweeted it as a joke. I was like, I before this time, I used Twitter like once every 7 months or something. So like, I wasn't active on Twitter.
Yeah,
so yeah. I don't know why. I was just like, I'll just tweet it, like, just sit Prince Harry in my business card. Hopefully, I'll get the gig. Put my phone in my pocket. About 20 minutes later, they come back out of the studio. Like I said, I didn't get to go in. Everyone's gone. My phone's still in my pocket. And then I take my phone was like, Giovanni, check, you're on Twitter. Like, blah, blah. I was like, what? So I took my phone out, and my phone was just tweeting. Like,
no,
that video had been played, like, I don't know, like, I think across the different platforms, 500,000 times or something.
Wow.
And shared, and I had like ITV, CNN all messaging me saying, oh, can we use your video? Can we use your... So, because I was excited at first, I was like, yeah, 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 go for it. Then afterwards, like, the lawyer in me came in, I was like, wait a minute, like, they're using all these videos and stuff, but actually they could pay, like, they still want to push the video. I can probably monetize this, like, and
oh,
like,
really?
Yeah. So, like, I'd initially said yes because of the excitement to like a few people, and then they were using it, and then I started getting people messaging me saying, oh, don't say yeah, like, you can monetize this, like Lad Bible, they wanted to use the video and stuff and that, and then in the end, like, I was able to monetize that video as well and stuff, and
into some way.
Like, from a few different like publications and that, and then yeah, like, I came out of the station, and then I did an interview with Channel 5, ITV and stuff, and then, but I thought that it was just going to be a day thing, like, but it just kept on, like, gathering
going,
momentum.
Going. Yeah,
and
yeah.
I remember I was due to go to Paris for work for this conference with Nissan, Nissan and Renault, they had a partnership, it was a conference, and then Good Morning Britain got in touch with me, and they were like, are you able to come on the show tomorrow morning? And I was like, I've got to go for a work conference, can we do it on like Friday? And they were like, oh no, it'd have to be tomorrow, kind of thing. And then, so I was like, to work, I was like, like, what do I do here? Like, and then, yeah, like, in the end, I ended up going on Good Morning Britain, and then, yeah, like, that just, it
wow.
just, yeah, yeah. So, yeah, like, literally, that definitely, like, gave me the belief that, you know what, anything can happen, you know, like, so.
Right, like. Mm. Right place, right time. The fact that you were part of that radio station,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
for a long time, you yeah, know, yeah. all that, like, leaving, taking a half day, doing that, like, there's so many things that had to happen. And even just being there for you to have the right, like, the confidence, or like, you know, they're like, fuck it, like, here's my business card, mm. and let's see what happens. Mm. That's a fantastic story. You should put that on your Instagram, bro.
Yeah. No, do you know what? Like, actually, so,
you should say that on Instagram. Yeah. I guarantee you'll get a million things.
Yeah. Now, do you know what? So I used to actually like have that on my even in my email signature at one point, it was all there. Then it got to a point where I was like, I don't want to be known
as that.
Yeah. So that's why I kind of like, I because there are certain videos and stuff that every so often I'll archive and then I'll put back on my Instagram and stuff, like, but yeah, like, for example, like KSI, like, they were all oblivious to, they didn't know about the whale thing, and then it was only like, it came up in conversation, like, maybe like a month or two, and we was on the tour on the road and that, and then we were just talking, and then there was like, oh, no way, I didn't know that, like, and then like, even like my business partner in Dubai, so I met him about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, and he'd heard about the story and stuff, but he didn't realize it was me until about 8 months ago, and he was like, I just realized this. And I was like, because we actually live in the same like tower.
Okay.
And and then I'd met this couple in the tower, and then like we were just speaking, etc. And then they connected with me, and I was like, yeah, come down to the brunch that we're running. And then basically like a month later, they met my business partner in the tower, and they were like, my business partner said what he does, and then they were like, oh, we met this DJ in the building, he's really cool, and he's done his stuff with Prince Harry. I didn't tell them about the Prince Harry stuff, they must have just like, searched it out or whatever.
Yeah.
And then he was like, huh?
That's my guy. Man, that's an awesome story.
Yeah,
bro. That's nice. Insane. I can't believe it was crazy just to read it. I had no idea you actually played it. So last question on this, I don't know details, but how long was it after? Did you think when you gave it to him, did you like were you just thinking about like, oh yeah, that was like, I did a cool thing. Okay, all this cool stuff has happened because of, did you ever think that they would come back and be like, yes, like we want
no,
to.
No. Like,
how long did it, like, what was the time frame?
So yeah, like, I mean, because the petition got created to like.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it got, no, and it gathered momentum. And I think, so ultimately, like, it came down to like, they were like, oh, we'd love to give you this this gig, etc. However, like, you know, the petition thing makes it a bit difficult because from a political point of view, you know, like, if someone does a petition and says, I don't know, like, Prince Harry should become a vegan, you know, like,
oh,
like,
I see.
Oh, you did it for this, but why didn't you do it for this? Why didn't you do it for this and all that?
I see, okay. And
so, yeah, like, I can't get too much into it all and stuff. But like, in terms of, like, did I ever think, you know, from the moment when we're giving the business card, did I ever think the chain of events that happened after would have happened? No,
nah,
like,
never.
I think when I gave him the business card, I just genuinely was like, oh, maybe they need a DJ, you know? Like, I wasn't thinking, I'm going to give you this business card and as a result of me doing this right now, I'm going to go viral. Like, it was more kind of just like...
In the moment.
Yeah, I was just like, let me just, you know, I do to anyone. It's like, oh, you need a DJ, here's a card. Like, you know?
Hit me up if you need me.
Yeah.
Wow, man, that's crazy. Mm. I had no idea. That's awesome. That's an awesome story, man. Nice. I wanted to come back to just a couple more questions for you, Jev. Mm. Looking back now, I guess, over your career as a DJ, as a producer, as a musician, I guess, what is the some of the biggest lessons you've learned, like maybe either about the art itself or just being in that, you know, that industry or personally for yourself?
That's a good question. Like, I think for me, one of one of the biggest lessons that I've learned is that you create your own opportunities. You know, like, not to rely on other people to do it for you, you know. So like, when I actually first, you know, was in, like, when I finished law school and stuff, I remember like trying to get DJ gigs in London, and it was hard, like, you know,
yeah, of course,
knocking on doors and like, you know, and not necessarily, you know, getting the gigs and stuff. But at the same time, I knew that I probably wasn't trying as hard because, you know, I had a career that I was focusing on.
Exactly, yeah.
But then I was just like, you know what? I'm going to create my own parties and DJ at my own parties. And then from DJing at my own events, I noticed that people were like, oh, he's bringing a crowd to his events.
Yeah.
Let's try and book him for it. So that's when I realized that, you know, you create your own opportunities and stuff, like, and you shouldn't wait for someone to hand you something. And it's the same, like, for me, even when I moved to Dubai, I wasn't initially, I knew I was going to do, like, old school brunch, but my goal wasn't to do, like, loads and more other events and stuff. Like, my goal was to do old school brunch and come out here and DJ and stuff. And then I DJed for a couple of people and that. And then I think eventually, whether because they wanted to get someone more affordable or what, for other reasons, I noticed that they stopped asking me to DJ and stuff, like, and then in my head I was like, well, I've got other people that are asking me to DJ, that's fine anyway, sure. But I was like, I'm just gonna set up my own stuff, and then again now, like, because I've set up my own stuff, you know, I've got people that are asking me to DJ like every day of the week and that. And it's only actually the last few weeks that I said to myself, actually, yeah, I'll DJ for other people as well. Initially I was like, I'll just DJ, I'm running 3 events a week, I'll just DJ at those, and that's me. I need to really get involved. And also it means that if people want to come out and see me DJ, they're coming to my events rather than someone else's events.
Gotcha. Yeah.
And it's only kind of when I went back to London most recently, I was like, just looking at ways to add to my income and stuff. And that, not that I need to, but just because I was just like, what else could I be doing, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
And one of the things I was like, well, why don't I like take on some more DJ work, you know? Like, so, it's just, I think that's the biggest lesson is, you create your own opportunities.
Yeah.
You know, like, don't wait, don't feel entitled to something, you know, like, work and create your own opportunity.
I respect that a lot, man. I think that's a really good lesson that you've learned for yourself and thing to take. And looking at the thing, you know, the Prince Harry thing, for example, you know, like, knocking door, trying to build yourself in such a competitive space. Like, everyone wants to be a musician, everyone wants to be the next, you know, Drake or, you know, whatever that might be. So I can't imagine how difficult it is. So the fact that you've at least been able now to get yourself to a pretty level that you're happy with, is awesome, man. So congrats on that.
Thanks.
I wanted to touch on one, just come back to the whole, because I think people would be interested, how you started like working with KSI.
Yeah.
I'm sure like some of the boys might might be interested to know how.
So KSI, that came about through at Represent again. Interesting. Represent seems to be like the
that's the thing. I actually saw you did a post about them, and you're like, thank you guys for supporting me from like the beginning and stuff. So sounds like I have a special place, you know.
Definitely. I mean, there's quite a lot of people that have come from Represent. So like, I don't know on social media if you've heard of a guy called Munyo.
No,
he does a lot of like on Instagram. He does a lot of like memes and videos and content and stuff. But he's really blown up, especially in the UK and stuff. That he started on Represent. A lot of the people that are at the top now in BBC and KISS and all the radio and TV stuff in the UK came from Represent. So for the UK, Represent is very, very, very much a breeding ground for like talent and stuff.
Oh, that's awesome.
I had my show on Represent, and we had a dancehall artist called Popcorn performing at Wembley Arena, and I got given some tickets to give away on my show. I'd done a competition, and then we had about 4 or 5 tickets left, and I decided I'd treat like my production assistant. So we all went along, and one of my assistants asked if he could bring his cousin and his cousin's girlfriend. So I was like, yeah, sure. Like, so they came along, I looked after them all, made sure they got food and drinks and stuff. And then a few weeks later, his cousin messaged me and was like, oh yeah, thanks for the other week and stuff. KSI's team, because he knew KSI team, they hit him up, they're like, asking for a DJ, and he put my details forward, and straight there and then in my mind I was like, that this is why you should always be generous, like, because you never know
exactly
what could come off the back of it.
Pay it forward
100%. Like, I did it not expecting anything, and just by me doing that, I was at the forefront of his mind. So then he obviously had hit up KSI with my details, and then KSI's management at the time had reached out to me and then asked if I had any mixes and stuff. So I sent them a couple of mixes that I'd had, and I got invited to DJ for, they had a VidCon show. It's like a YouTube
event, right?
Yeah. And he was performing, him and Randolph. So then I came and DJed for their performances, and then we all got along, and then they were like, do you want to come on tour? I was like, yeah, why not? We went on tour. We did like a UK tour and then a European tour, which was fun, man. Like,
I can imagine
it was so much fun. That we've done about 4 tours now since then.
That's awesome, man.
Yeah, we've got another one sort of mid-end January and Feb, like a UK and a European one.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So you got just every time there's a tour, you fly back and you go on the tour for
and
a while.
This is what I love, like, is that, because I still do the law stuff. I've still got like a couple of clients that I freelance with it.
Yeah.
But what I love is that where I always wanted to be is where I dictate my schedule, you know?
Exactly.
And
exactly.
Thankfully, like, I'm blessed, like, grateful that I'm able to do that at the moment, you know? Like, if I want to go to London, I can just go to London, you know? Like,
yeah, hop on a flight and just head over, right?
Yeah, like literally. And, you know, that's one of the, because actually a dilemma that I had, we didn't touch on this earlier, actually, is that towards the end of last year, beginning of this year, I basically had the dilemma of going back to the UK and pursuing my BBC, like a career in the BBC, on BBC Radio 1 and stuff, versus being in Dubai and you know, having my career, etc., and stuff like that.
That's a tough decision.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a big opportunity.
Yeah, like, and ultimately I decided to not go back to London because for me, I'd left like my career in law, and you know, I didn't want to work for someone, and like going back to the BBC, it's a big corporate organisation. Like, yeah, I feel like I'd be, you know, going back
into that world
as a junior as well, like, because as much as I'd have a show on Radio 1, you know, like, I'd be very much new in the organisation, so I'd have to put the work in and, you know, and grind. And like, right now, I'd rather grind to build my own empire, do you know what I mean? Yeah. Rather than like when I was in my 20s, yeah, I would have, you know, I would have done that, you know, but now I'm in my 30s, so it's like,
it's a bit different. Yeah, yeah. And I respect that, man. And like you said, listening to, you know, your story about, you know, leaving a, you know, like the corporate world, or like just, you know, a typical job, and when you're starting to do your own thing, I'm going through that too right now as well. So like,
yeah.
I did a solo podcast the other day. I just released it today about what I've learned this year as like my first year of starting a business. Like, I did not think, you know, it would be this hard. You know, you kind of do what I do in the sense that besides the event side, your service is you. Mm-hmm. You're the service, you know, you're the whole company, you know, as Jev. Yeah. And I thought that the fact that I don't need other people, you know, I don't have overheads, I don't have a product, you know, whatever, it would make my life, you know, easier. Mm. And I've learned that it's anything but. comes with its own, you know, list of challenges. So I think for anyone who wants to like take that step, it's not easy, but you know, if you really love it, I think, you know, it's, if you, and you can afford to like take that chance, I think it's worth it.
Yeah, no, 100%. Yeah. I agree, man. And it's good that you've taken that step as well, you know, like, and that's the thing, like you're never really ready for anything, are you?
That's
and
true.
Sometimes, you know, you just have to just do, and then you learn along the way and stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think a lot of times, all of us at some, we go through this at different points, you know, you want to do something, but there's a million reasons not to. So it overwhelms you, you don't do it, but then start and figure it out. Kind of like what I did, kind of like what you did, you know, and here we are now, like a year, 2 years, 5 years later. Jeff, I just have three more questions for you.
Yeah, sure.
So in quite a short amount of time, man, respect to you, you've done, you know, quite a lot, you know, you've worked with lots of artists and, you know, toured around the world and DJed here. And now you got this whole setup here. I guess for you, I'm curious, what's the dream, or like what's that like, maybe and like from a musical side, like what's like the one dream event that you're like, once I play that, I'll be like, I'm, you know, I'm I've things will build, but I'm happy, you know. I'm good.
I think for me, the dream, the goal has shifted a little bit over the last like year. So this time last year, I think my goal would have been to be like the next, in terms of stature and being known, like say DJ Khaled.
Okay. And like, right, that level.
Yeah, that level.
Going big boy.
Nice. Now, if I'm honest with you, my dream is financial freedom.
Sure.
And like, and if I can achieve that through doing what I enjoy, then so be it, you know. And like, I think, like in terms of like where I'd love to play, like I've played some really cool places and stuff. Like, I'd love to headline, because I've played before, but I'd love to headline Coachella or Glastonbury.
Ooh, that would be insane.
I've been Coachella several times.
You played at Coachella?
Yeah, I played, but it's like in the
smaller tents.
And
that's still sick though.
But you know, like I've been there and I've been on the stage and like, you know, I've seen like whether it's like Diplo or Calvin Harris or you know, like T'Chami or like, you know, all these, even DJ Khaled there and stuff like, and I just felt this thing of like, that's gonna be me one day. And I think, you know, like this last year, because I was changing where I lived, it meant my focus wasn't fully on the music as such. It was I was focusing on creating an event company out here and resettling, relocating. So next year, I'm going to focus on all of that. And also, I want to publish a book next year as well.
Oh, no way. Have you been writing one?
I've kind of got in vague, like the chapters and stuff, like
cool.
In terms of like what they're called and what's going to be within them. I just need to start like building that out, you know, and so like that's what I'm gonna kind of focus on a bit more next year as well.
Yeah,
so
that's awesome, man. I had no idea you were writing a book. Do we have a name for the book yet? We can announce it here.
I'll keep the name quiet for now.
Okay, then, that's fine.
Once like, because it could change. There is one potential name, but it could change once I've finished the book. I think it might change, because even now, like
It feels different.
It feels different a bit, to what it was before. So.
Yeah, that's fair. I've had a guest on the podcast before that, who trains people how to write books.
So he
can help you write a book in like 12 weeks.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay. From like idea to that. He obviously different types of books, like different types of stuff. But you know, if you need a connection, I can always put you.
That'd be great.
Because he's good. And he always said that. He's been writing a. Like when it's a focus book, like a business book or a book about a specific topic, his program works. But for example, he's been writing a novel now for over 10 years. And he told me on the podcast, he's like, I'm put a final date to release it in 2022. So all listening to his story and listening to like what you're going through, as you go through life, as things come up, you might include things in chapters, you might move, you know, so the meaning or the what the book is could change too. I get that. Mm. Jeff, I just got two more questions for you, my man. And thank you again so much for your patience, bro. I appreciate it.
Pleasure, man.
Number one, these are questions I ask all my guests. Mm-hmm. Looking back, I guess, either personally or professionally or whatever, you know, resonates with you, what are you most proud of for yourself?
Oh, that's a good question. What am I most proud of? I'm proud, I'm proud, you know, that, like, that I was able to, you know, go to law school and, you know, like, I went to law school, I was the only black guy in my law school, like.
Oh, really?
Yeah, literally. Oh, wow. And, you know, like, even when I went into my law firm, like, you know, like, there was a couple in my intake that wasn't, you know, and so I'm proud that, you know, like, I was able to kind of, you know, represent where I'm from and, you know, like, achieve a career in law, you know, and, you know, and... And I'm also proud that, you know, I was able to go into music and, you know, like, not just be, like, you know, not entry level, if that makes sense, you know, actually excel in that as well, you know.
I'm proud of that.
I'm proud of, you know, to be honest with you, though, the thing that, and this was so long ago when I'd done this, but the thing that actually, when I look back and I'm like, that's actually such an amazing experience for me that I've done, was like me volunteering in an orphanage in Malaysia. This is all the way in 2009, and I think when I look back sort of on all my experiences in life, I think that for me will always like be significant, you know. But yeah, I guess like in terms of like from a music point of view, it's weird because like I don't see, I guess because it feels like a lot of time I'm having fun.
So
it almost just feels like, well, that was fun. So I'm not proud of it, you know, it was just fun, you know? But yeah, I think, you know, like, ultimately, I guess I'm proud that, you know, I've been able to get to a place where, because I was, you know, worried that, you know, I'd leave law and, you know, where does my life go, you know?
It might not work out, you know?
I'm proud that, you know, and I'm thankful that, you know, I'm where I am today, you know.
That's awesome, man. And I think it's interesting that you said that you don't look at it as like work because you're having fun doing it. You know what I mean? It doesn't feel like a milestone. It just feels like you've had fun and it's a thing. But I think you know, to make that huge transition and to take that big leap, I think anyone who does that it's admirable and respected, and because a lot of times it doesn't work out, but for you it has. So congrats on that, my man. That's awesome. And Jeff, for my last question that I ask all my guests, what is the message you'd like everyone to take home with them today?
I think the key messages I'd like people to take home are, if you're trying to, you know, start something or pursue something, be consistent. But also, don't wait on anyone to take your shot, you know, to shoot your shot. Like, using even just the Prince Harry example, like, you know, I just shot my shot. And, you know, if I didn't shoot my shot, then maybe we would meet, like, I wouldn't be on this podcast, you know, maybe we would have crossed paths because, you know, I'd probably still be working on that 5-year plan to leave law, you know. So I probably wouldn't, you know, have come to Dubai in the way that I have and stuff. So I think, always shoot your shot, whether you work in a corporate environment and, you know, and you want to, you know, you want to take on some more clients within your business, or you want to kind of work on a new project, or you want to like push for promotion and stuff, ask the question, because if you don't ask, it's always going to be no. And then I think, yeah, like branding, always, you know, think about yourself as a brand, whatever you do, whether you're working in the corporate field or whether you're working in the creative spaces, your brand essentially, like in the sense that, like when you go to an interview, like I mentioned earlier, like you go to an interview, you wouldn't go into an interview wearing a tracksuit bottom if you're applying to be a lawyer or an accountant or something, or an architect. So, and the reason why you wouldn't do that is because you know that you're going to be looked at as, oh, this doesn't fit with the brand of what we're doing.
So
work out where it is you want to be and work out, does your brand, you know, work for that, and, you know, just branding it. So
Man, that's awesome. I think I really like what you said, not necessarily about the consistency, but, you know, take a shot. You know, don't wait around for people to, you know, for it to come to you. I think that's something that's a even something that I didn't maybe realize enough of myself as well. So it's really, it's really, really great advice. And like you said, that one event, that small like incident, that 1 second, you know, has led to, you know, so much for you. So I think it's a, that story is a great reminder of why you should be doing that. And like you said, always think of yourself as a brand, because you never know who's looking and what, you know, what they might need you for.
This is it. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's awesome advice, man. Jev, I want to say thank you so much for coming on the show, bro.
Yeah.
This has been so much fun and it's been an absolute pleasure, man. I've learned, really loved the conversation. Even with round two, we dove into other areas. Yeah. So it's been fun. Really fun.
Yeah.
For if people want to connect with you, follow you, get in touch with you, how can they do that?
Yes.
Let us know.
Yeah, no, sure. So you can get at me on Instagram, Jevani Letford, JevAnniLetford. And yeah, I'm contactable via that. That's probably the best way.
Okay.
My website is JevaniLetford.com. And you can send me an email via like the website as well. But Instagram DM is probably the
Instagram
fastest.
DM.
Yeah.
All right, done. So guys, you got all the info. In case you want to ever get in touch, Jev, man, thank you so much again for coming on the show.
Pleasure, man.
Guys, to everyone listening, as always, thank you so much for listening. Follow the podcast, subscribe, comment, share at hope.it.helps with two S's on Instagram and everywhere else. And as always, guys, hope it helps. Peace.
Peace.